Hi, welcome to the podcast. I am Joe Posnanski, senior writer at Sports on Earth, sportsonearth.com. Welcome to the show. Very, very excited to have back our regular co-host of the podcast, Mike Schur. Michael, senior producer, or executive producer, excuse me, of the great show Parks and Recreation. And we are going to try something new this week. Well, we're actually going to try two new things this week. The first thing we're going to try is we are going to, because I have a bet on this, we're going to keep the show in an hour. We're going to do this entire show in 1 hour.
You have already lost that bet. It's just give the person the money now.
It's one of my children is what I bet.
Oh, really?
Yes. So, but we just got a dog, so I guess that could make up for it.
All right.
And then the second thing we're going to do, and I think you would agree with me on this. This week, unlike all these other, we've been doing these goofy drafts, these like silly kind of waste of time drafts. I think you and I both decided kind of independently, but we came together on this, a very serious draft this week. Am I right?
Yeah. Yes. In the past, it's been kind of pointless and frivolous. And this week, we were like, all right, let's try to really just do something that has meaning, that's actually meaningful.
Well, we're in an election season. There's so many issues out there. I thought, finally, let's do something kind of important. So
yeah, because we want this to be entertaining, but we also want it to be informational. You know, we want people to feel like they've learned something at the end of the 7 hours that it takes us to get through one of these podcasts.
And I think that's important to know, because if at the end of this thing, all you got out of it was, you know, me beating you in the draft or something, that's not enough. That's not enough, I think, for the average
league. It's not enough. It's also never happened. So I'm 9-0 or whatever it is so far. So, well, whatever. The point is that the draft this week is actually, we want it to actually be informational and important, and kind of hopefully the people will come away thinking that they've learned something.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope people don't think we took it too seriously either. I mean, we don't want to lose the fun, but I think
that definitely is, we're running that risk with the draft topic. We're running the risk that people feel like we were being preachy or lecturing to them. But at the same time, I think it's worth the risk.
This week, for one week, we'll try it. I don't even need to say anything as we start going around the horn with baseball. Other than the words Derek Jeter. I mean, that's usually enough to get us both set off anyway. But we're doing this, recording this on a Tuesday in October, just in case this doesn't get posted for a few years. And we just saw 2 days ago, we just saw Derek Jeter on a ball hit to his left, which has been, by the way, the start of a punchline many times, ball hit to Jeter's left. He goes down. And is writhing on the way. Well, he's not writhing, but he's on the floor. He's on the ground. He's in obvious and agony. He can't even put any weight on it. He shatters his ankle. He's out for the season. Your feelings?
Well, my first feeling was this stinks, which is a very, very confusing feeling for me to have about Derek Jeter, anything bad happening to Derek Jeter. But it was my first thought. It was this stinks. This is not ever the way that any sports fan wants things to go, regardless of your rooting affiliations. And there was a lot of symbolism, I think, wrapped up in this, in that game, in those two games that he played in the series. He flared a single to right center field for his 200th career postseason hit. If you look at Derek Jeter's postseason statistics, he has essentially played an entire season in the postseason over his career. Almost exactly.
Yeah, 159 games. I mean, almost
159 games. It's like 726 plate appearances. He's put up like an 840 OP. He's had a Derek Jeter season in the postseason. And he got his 200th hit in the postseason, which is absurd. If you really think about how often you have to be in the postseason and how well you have to play. He got his 200th hit, and then he got injured. And now you have to ask the question, will he ever play in the postseason again? He's got, I think, 1 year left on his deal. And he could sign another deal, obviously. But the Yankees' problems have been exposed, I think, in the postseason a lot. And who knows how well he'll recover from the ankle injury. And it's just a huge bummer, because no matter who you root for or what team you root for, the last thing in the world you ever want to see is a guy like Derek getting hurt in the postseason. It just stinks. What I want to see, make no doubt about it, is his team lose and for him to be miserable. I want to see that shot of him. You know, in 2001, when the Diamondbacks beat the Yankees, my friend Mike Stone called me excitedly in the immediate aftermath and said, look what we're seeing on TV. Derek Jeter is sad. I've never seen Derek Jeter sad. It's never happened. And that's what I want to see. I want to see the Yankees having lost a series, but the last thing in the world that I want to see, and I think anyone really wants to see, is that. And it was a huge, huge bummer, and it really kind of disturbs me in a very deep and meaningful way.
Yeah, it was awful. It was awful to see. And by the way, I should say that from your perspective, not only do you want to see the Yankees lose and Derek Jeter miserable, it would not bother you at all if it ended with Derek Jeter hitting into a triple play. I mean, that would
not. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Look, before the 2004 ALCS, after the 2003 ALCS when the Red Sox got blown out lost in the seventh game on the Aaron Boone home run, I may have told the story before, I apologize, but my same friend asked me how I wanted it to go. When the Red Sox finally beat the Yankees, how I wanted it to go. And my answer was, I wanted the Yankees to be up 9-0 in game four with a 3-0 lead. I wanted Rivera to come in, and I wanted the Yankees to lose game four on 30 consecutive Derek Jeter errors. Just 30 consecutive ground balls to Derek Jeter that went right through his legs. And then I wanted the Red Sox to come back and win in seven games. And I would be thrilled if it were just play on the field, if it were failure on the field and just the run of play. That's what I want. But an injury is just such a it's the reason sports is so heartbreaking. It's because things like that happen that don't have to do with just the actual hitting and throwing and running and everything else. And it just stinks because you want the teams to play each other at full strength and you want the best team to win.
Yeah, and you don't want a guy. I mean, for all the feelings about Derek Jeter, you don't want a guy. It wasn't just an injury. I mean, an injury where a guy gets hurt, then he gets pulled out, you know, the next half inning, and like, oh, that's bad enough. But
yeah,
watch him sprawled out there on the ground like that and, you know, scream in pain and all that. It was awful. It was an awful thing to see. But it's only one of like 50 like Russian novel moments for the Yankees in this series. This series is amazing to me. Obviously you have that. Obviously you have this incredible Alex Rodriguez story that just keeps getting more. I mean, at some point, there's no doubt in my mind, at some point, Joe Girardi is going to come up to Alex Rodriguez and hit him in the face. That is literally the only thing he has not done to him at this point. I mean, he's pinch hit for him, then he pinch hit for him again, then he benched him, then he pinch hit for him down four runs in the eighth inning. It was like Billy Martin pulling Reggie Jackson in the middle of an inning or something. At this point, there's nothing left other than maybe, you know, he might give him a hot foot or something. I mean, you know, some old baseball thing or whatever. There's nothing left to be done. So you have that. And then, as if all of that's not just, like, insane enough, you got Robinson Cano is 0 for 800 this postseason. As if all of that's not enough, Nick Swisher decides he has to be a part of it, too. Nick Swisher was like complaining the fans are booing him or something. And so, I mean, it really was Nick Swisher going, look, there's misery happening and I'm not getting enough of it. I mean, I have to be a bigger part of this story. I'm telling you, you know, this is, you always wondered because the Yankees were not only good for so long, they were good in a way, even when they lost, even in the early 2000s when they lost in those heartbreaking games, even in the mid-2000s when they were kind of trying to find their way, you always kind of felt like there was an invincibility about them. Like, all right, well, phew, we survived this year, but next year the Yankees are going to be good again. And this one feels like just the angel of death is just over them and just looking down and going, time's up. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's how it feels.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, we've talked about this before, but how many times in the last 10 years? I mean, Buster only wrote a book about the 2001 season called The Last Days of the Yankee Dynasty or whatever it was called. And then they've been in the playoffs every year except one since then, and they won the World Series a few years ago. I mean, I am chomping at the bit every year to declare them, you know, in a massive rebuilding phase and whatever, but they never are. But so who knows? I mean, look, they could beat Verlander tonight in Detroit. And because, I mean, there's like the ironic thing is A-Rod this year has like is like 4-for-6 with 2 home runs off Verlander. And I don't, who knows if he'll even play. But they could beat Verlander tonight. They could beat whoever the Tigers throw in game. They could be right back in this thing. I mean, they could win this series in 6 games. They've done that before, certainly. There was a really funny, I saw a headline the other day that said Shane Spencer says the Yankees need to channel the spirit of 1996. And I was like, man, that's how bad things have gotten for the Yankees that now Shane Spencer is weighing in from wherever Shane Spencer is to say, like, hey, I've got some advice for you guys.
Yeah,
like, now they have to listen to Shane Spencer. But the thing is, you know, A-Rod is obviously the lightning rod. He always is every postseason, no matter what happens. It doesn't matter that, you know, he had a monster, you know, postseason a couple of years ago. His failures are always at the forefront. And he's taking all the heat off of all the other guys on the team. I mean, Granderson is 3-for-26 or something. You know, I think he's got one home run. That's his only extra base hit. Cano is 3-for-30. Swisher's 2-for-28. I mean, no one is hitting in the lineup. The fact is that A-Rod is the only person they want to talk about. And that kind of weird Yankee postseason magic that occurred when they pinch hit for him with Ibanez and Ibanez hit the 2 home runs only served if they had pulled Granderson and Ibanez had hit for Granderson and done that same thing, no one would be talking about how Granderson is a huge failure this postseason. It's because it's A-Rod and he has this history of having either huge postseason series or terrible postseason series. And this one is this year, it's both of them have been terrible. And so he is serving as, I mean, he's the official lightning rod of the team. It's been like that for a long time, but he's masking a team-wide failure. I mean, across the board, except for Raul Ibanez, except for 72-year-old Raul Ibanez, everyone on this team is underperforming. And I have to say that we talked about this the last time we did this podcast, is they are a one-dimensional offensive team for the most part. They hit home runs and that's it. And as you've seen in this postseries, they've only won when they hit home runs. And they only came back from that 4-0 lead because they hit 2 home runs in the 9th inning. And that's the deal with them. I mean, look at Curtis Granderson's stats. He's Curtis Granderson. You wouldn't think about it because he's physically a completely different player. He was Adam Dunn this year. He had 43 home runs and 135 or what something total hits. He struck out 200 times and he hit 230. That's what Adam Dunn does. So it's, you know, that's the deal with this team. They either hit home runs and win or they don't and they lose. And right now they're running up against some good pitching and they have a massive hill to climb. But this is not A-Rod's fault. This is the team's fault.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, A-Rod is always, and it's interesting because that was always balanced out. I mean, people always hated A-Rod, but they loved Jeter. So it was, you know, in New York that was able to balance out. Now there's no Jeter. So the teeter-totter is just completely on the A-Rod side, which is the trouble. But it is interesting, and you say this, and like I say, people, this podcast might not even be posted until after the Verlander game, but you'll know, in some ways, that's the perfect game for the Yankees to have to play. I mean, if they lose the Verlander and get shut out, they're going to lose the series, they're done, we get it. But if you're going to come back from this with Jeter hurt, with A-Rod in pain, and with nobody hitting, with you know the team just being a complete wreck, the only way that happens is you beat Justin Verlander, right?
Yeah.
You do that, and then all of a sudden the entire series is different. The Tigers, let's face it, do you have any faith in the Tigers? No, nobody does. So. And it's amazing because the Tigers are, at this point, especially with Jeter hurt, the Tigers are really kind of the star-studded team of this series. I mean, they're the ones with Cabrera and Fielder and Verlander. I mean, they're the ones that they've got their own, you know, crazy closer to just, you know, throw fun and joy into the middle of this thing. And yet nobody cares. It's like it's all about the Yankees. And if the Yankees find a way to beat Verlander – like you're right. I mean, they could end up winning this thing, going to the World Series, winning the World Series, and all of this hopeful, wishful, the Yankees are finally at the end thinking is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's entirely possible. I mean, they've come back too many times, and they've played tough too many times to write them off. I mean, tonight is obviously incredibly important, but it raises a larger issue, actually, which is that the thing that I was bummed out about, as good as the first round of the playoffs was, but I was really bummed out that I felt that the four best stories in baseball, the Reds, A's, Orioles, and Nationals, were all eliminated. Yes. They all lost their series. Yes. And that doesn't mean that the other teams aren't good stories. Obviously, you know, the Cardinals trying to win without Pujols is something, and the resurgence of Buster Posey is something, and the Yankees are always a thing, and the Tigers have, you know, Verlander and a bunch of stars. But to me, the Reds, A's, Orioles, and Nationals were all more interesting stories than the teams that beat them in advance. And that kind of bummed me out. I don't know if you had the same thought.
I did. And not only did I have the same thought, I had this idea of the absurdity of the five-game series. And all four series were amazing on their own terms. But,
yeah.
But at the end of them, it's sort of like March Madness in this way. Nothing is more fun than a bunch of early round upsets in March Madness. And you're just going, this is awesome. Duke lost and Kentucky lost and Kansas lost. And this is, and then you get to the Final Four and you're like, oh God, these teams are no good. They're the ones that left. this is terrible. Why? I mean, you know,
yeah.
And it's not to say the four teams that are left are all very good, obviously, but you have these five game series and with all these amazing stories, all four of the stories you talked about, we're not just good for this year. I mean, they're the last decade. Those are four of the best stories out there. I mean, the Nationals and the A's and the Orioles, especially those three, are just off the chart stories. And
yeah.
All three of those teams had very real chances to win their series.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously the Reds certainly did, and none of them did. And so at the end of the day, you're like, okay, well, now you could end up with like a Tigers Cardinals World Series. We just did that, right? I mean, it's
yeah.
Like, that doesn't. I don't want that again. I mean, no offense to those teams. Those teams are great, and the Cardinals are. There, you cannot kill the Cardinals.
I know
the absurdity of what the Cardinals have done the last 2 years. Okay, five consecutive series against teams with better records than them, five victories. It's insane. It's insane what they're doing.
Yeah, it was shocking. I mean, I kept checking in with that game, and it was like, I mean, I'm not by any stretch a Nationals fan, but it was like a nightmare. I mean, it was like, I checked this, the first time I checked the score was 6-0, and then it was just a slow creep. It was like, God, here come the Cardinals again. How are they doing this? And it makes me sad because I think that this is a very overused phrase, but I think it would have been good for baseball
yes.
if you had put Bryce Harper and Gio Gonzalez and the Nationals, that entire team, on the biggest stage. If the Nationals had made the NLCS and even the World Series, I think that just would have been good. It's something new. It's interesting. A lot of their players are young, and you know the same is true of the A's. I mean, the A's were throwing five rookie starters. And they were, you know, they caught the Rangers at the end and won the division. I mean, that was a great story. With so many injuries, McCarthy injured and Brett Anderson injured, trading Gio Gonzalez, everything they went through to get to that point. And the other thing is, of course, in the world of the Oakland A's, is that if they had actually won the World Series, then everyone would stop talking about how the A's never win the World Series, which
yes.
would be nice for me personally, and I'm sure for Billy Beane as well. But I don't know. I mean, it's baseball. Baseball's great. I'll watch all the playoff series, and they're all interesting, and there's still a lot of great stories. But it could have, I mean, Reds, Nationals, and A's, Orioles would have been some really weird, interesting series.
Well, it would have been different. I mean, I find myself doing this every year is, you know, as a writer, you always say, you know, one of the big sports writer cliches is you root for the story. But as a fan, I root for the city that hasn't had it in a long time.
Right.
You know, it's like the Tigers just, I mean, they're okay. They were there. The Yankees, obviously, we're sick of them. And then, you know, the Giants are really fun, and that's a great – I love that scene, and the city has embraced baseball in a way that it really never had in its entire history. But,
yeah.
But they just won. They're just there. The Cardinals, I mean, enough. I mean, with them, I mean, I'm the, – I don't have any, and it is a completely different, you know, Cardinals team than the one that won last year. I mean, not just Pujols being there, but I mean, you know, obviously Wainwright's back, and Chris Carpenter is like pitching with one arm now or whatever. I mean, what did he have? He had his rib taken out. So they are incredible, and I don't downplay that for a story. They're incredible, but they're not new, and those other teams were new.
Yeah,
you wanted to see how long it could go, that, especially with that A's team. You really just wanted to see how far could that team go, because there wasn't a day that I looked at that team and thought, yeah, that's a World Series contender right there, you know. But they just kept doing it and kept winning. The Orioles the same way, and it gets to the conversation a little bit of what we had last time we talked, but it's still worth bringing up again. There are a lot of mixed emotions with the way baseball does the playoffs now. I mean, you're getting a lot of great baseball, and I'm glued to it. I'm sitting in front of the TV watching all of it and loving it. So I'm not complaining, but it's different. There is a little bit of this is kind of a crapshoot, and you don't really know who's coming out of here, and you don't really get the sense of that there's any order to it at all. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I read that interview. Bud Selig did an interview, and he talked about how the competition committee was discussing that the one-game play-in. And his quote was that it was unanimous, that people approved it. The competition committee, or whatever it's called, is, you know, there's managers and GMs and all sorts of different kinds of people, and apparently everyone was on board. According to him, everyone was on board, even the managers of the teams, which he said he didn't expect. Now, I guess the idea is put a real incentive on winning the division. Like, you want to avoid this crapshoot, this coin flip, then win your division. And I get that, and that makes sense in like an intellectual way. But in the realpolitik of the situation, what ends up happening is you get a team that won, you know, 94 games, losing a one game playoff and not getting, you know, the entire season, the season's worth of work gets sort of wiped out in one day. Now, whatever, I guess that's good. That's interesting. It makes for interesting stories. And there are, there's obviously, before any of this system, there were stories of teams winning 100 games and not even making the playoffs because they just didn't pull it out. You know, it was a Giants team one year when the Braves won.
93, right? The Giants.
Yeah, they won 102 games or whatever it was.
Incredible.
It's a crazy good team. So I guess overall it's better that those teams get a shot. But I'm with you. It makes me very uneasy. The point of baseball to me is that it's about the season, and then it's about a series where you at least have something. You at least have it. Like, I mean, Chipper Jones called the shot. I don't know if you saw that quote, but he was saying he didn't like the system, and it was like, you know, you get one bad call by an umpire, and your whole season's down the drain, and then the infield fly rule thing happens. So, that's Chipper Jones' last playoff game. That's really sad. Now, I guess the counterpoint is, like, it's always going to be sad. It's like the NCAA tournament. There's always going to be a 65th team or a 69th team or a 78th team, whatever it is, that thinks, like, oh, we got screwed. We should have been in there. So there's nothing really to be done about that. But the point of baseball is that it isn't supposed to be. It's not the NFL. They play 162 games. And I feel like in a couple of years what we're going to see is that the first round of the playoffs is three games,
yes,
the second round is five, and then the championship series are seven.
Well, it didn't work this year, as far as I can tell. I mean, I'm talking about in the confines of how things go. It didn't work. In the National League, it certainly didn't work because, you know, it didn't involve winning a division. It was the Atlanta was the clear best wild card by record, and they didn't get up. They lost in their one game playoff. So for them, it didn't work. That just flat failed. In the American League, it kind of worked because we had that great Orioles Yankees thing down the stretch and that great Oakland Texas thing down the stretch. But would it really have worked any less if, you know, Oakland, Texas, I mean, they would have ended up playing, Texas and Baltimore would have ended up playing a one game playoff anyway for that one, for the playoff spot. So it didn't really work there either. And now it's just one year. And one thing I hate, and I've written this, I don't like it when people look at one year and then adjust to it. That's what the BCS did. Every year, they'd be like, oh, well, wait a minute. What happens if they're – this year we had three undefeated teams, so let's change the rules. And then the next year they'd have one undefeated team, and it would completely screw it up. And then they'd be like, okay, well, let's change the rules again. And they would just keep adjusting and creating the perfect system for last year. And
right.
Which never worked again. So I don't want baseball to do that, but it is true that we have now done 1 year of this, and you can't say it worked. I mean, you can't say it was fair. And the Braves, is it really fair? I mean, the Braves were, what, six games better than the Cardinals? I mean, that's, you know, to have to go to a one-game playoff with a six-game lead after 162, that doesn't seem like good math to me.
Yeah, I mean, just there's no good way to do it.
No.
That's true of all sports. The closest thing, and I think we've talked about this before, but the closest thing we have to a good system is the NFL, because there's an incentive for every. I mean, and it's easier for the NFL because it's all about what every game, every like week is one game, so it makes sense that they have the system. But there's an incentive to win your division. There's an incentive to try to win wild cards. There's an incentive to try to get a better record, even when you've locked up your division. The first two top two teams get the bye, they get home field advantage, blah, blah, blah. Like every slot is there's something for teams to fight for. But even in the NFL, you get these situations where teams have the same record,
sure.
And then you go to conference record, and then you go to division record, and then you go to points for and points against, and then you go to how many replays were overturned. There's 700 tiebreakers. And so no matter what, teams are going to get screwed every year, no matter what. But the NFL system seems to me to be the least screwed that teams.
Well, it's only because we've accepted it. I think that's what it is. Because seriously, you went through the tiebreakers. The last tiebreaker in the NFL is a coin flip. Now it's never come to a coin flip, but that is absolutely the last tiebreaker. Could you imagine? I mean, you should remember. I mean, it wasn't the Patriots. Weren't they one of the 10-win teams or the 11-win team to not make
11? Yeah, 11 the year Brady went down in 2008, Matt Cassel took over. They went 11-5 and didn't make the playoffs.
Didn't make the playoffs at 11-5. And if you had to explain to like somebody who's never watched an NFL game, you said, okay, well, so why didn't they make it? You'd have to explain. Well, it came down to this record and that record, and that person would look at you like that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah,
but we've accepted it. There was no real complaining about it. Like every year there's just constant complaining from the bubble teams at the NCAA tournament, right? They're just all the time just constantly going, we had this great this and we beat this team there. And it's just whining for like 3 days until they finally start playing the games. The New England Patriots won 11 games. Didn't make the playoffs. And as far as I know, I mean, there was a little bit of like, oh, that's too bad. But there wasn't any like, the system is terrible. And I think it's because it's the NFL. We've accepted it. We've accepted this is the limitation of a 16-game season. This is the importance of every game. If you tell us, I mean, literally, if they came out and they said, well, why did the Patriots not make the playoffs? Well, the smoke from the commissioner's chimney was the wrong color. that's too bad. I really wish that it worked out differently for us. But okay, if that's what happened, that's what happened. And
I guess you're right. It's also been the system now for a few years,
yes.
And it seems like, and you know, I just think that people are, I think you're right. I think people are generally more accepting of everything in the NFL than they are in any other sport just because people love the NFL so much.
we are 28 minutes in, so I'm keeping an eye on the clock here. So we're going to go, we're going to talk a little NFL, and then to the draft.
Sounds good.
I mean, are you ready for this draft? I mean, do you feel?
Well, I mean, I stayed up last night. I did a lot of research. I read a lot of legal briefs, and I think that I'm intellectually prepared. I don't know what arguments or counterarguments you've come up with,
right.
But I think I've done my homework on this, so I think I'm ready.
All right, I think so too. I think I'm ready too, but I'm a little nervous. It's just such new ground for us, you know. I mean,
yeah.
I'm just a little nervous about that. All right, as you and I both predicted in our NFL preview show that we actually never did live, that nobody actually ever heard, but we did on our own, the Falcons are the only undefeated team in the NFL. It was so good for us to predict that.
It really was.
I'm pretty amazed by it. I mean, you said Houston could be Houston, but I said, no, I think we got to stick with the Falcons, and you agreed with me.
Yes, that we both made that call. It's a shame that it wasn't recorded. and then no one ever heard it. But we both said unequivocally that the Falcons would be 6-0 after six games.
How can you? I mean, every team in the AFC East is 3-3.
Yes,
the Falcons are 6-0.
There are two teams in the entire AFC with winning records at this moment. Two. The Ravens are 5-1, and Houston is 5-1. Every other team is 500 or below.
What is this? I mean, this is that word. The first time I ever heard the word parody, like parity, was in the NFL, and it was probably sometime in the 80s. But that was like syllabus was like the first time I heard the word syllabus when I went to college. First time I heard the word parody was the NFL, and they've been talking about parody forever. Is there a good team in the NFL, like a really, truly good team in the NFL?
That's the question that keeps being asked. My thing is, I think every team is good and also terrible. I tweeted this the other day. I said, I don't know how this is possible, but every team in the NFL is better than every other team.
Yes.
And a lot of people wrote back and wrote, no, I'm a Chiefs fan and the Chiefs are terrible. Or, no, I'm a Cleveland fan and Cleveland's terrible. But then you start doing these things, and you can do this. You've been able to do this for the last couple of years in the NFL. But you go, okay, who is a bad team? Well, the Bills are a bad team. The Bills, you know, get slaughtered all the time. The Bills have a point differential of negative 55. They've been outscored by 55 points through six games. So you say, okay, the Bills are terrible. Well, guess what? The Bills beat the Cardinals by 3 last week.
Yes.
The Cardinals beat the Patriots by 2 a few weeks ago. And then the Patriots beat the Bills by 80. So what does that tell you? It doesn't. And then you go, okay, well, Cleveland stinks, right? Well, Cleveland beat Cincinnati by 10. Cincinnati beat the Redskins by 7. The Redskins beat Minnesota by 12. Minnesota beat San Francisco by 11. San Francisco beat the Jets by 34. The Jets beat the Colts by 26, and this Sunday the Colts are playing the Browns, and would anybody be surprised if the Colts beat the Browns by 100 points?
No.
It's so crazy. There is absolutely no way to predict anything that happens in the NFL in any given week. And this is, I mean, the old phrase, any given Sunday, has been around for a while. But my goodness gracious, who in the world would have predicted the Giants going to San Francisco and beating the stuffing out of them last week? Who would have predicted the Patriots losing to Seattle? I mean, the Patriots are obviously the team I follow the closest. They have 3 losses by a total of 4 points. It is a ridiculous league. It makes no sense. And there is, I think the worst way to spend your time right now is to bet on the NFL.
Yeah,
absolute worst thing you can do with your time and money is bet on the NFL.
Money especially. It is amazing because, especially this year, and this year seems to me, maybe it's not different, but it feels different to me because certain themes popped up this year that were new. Suddenly, Arizona had this incredible defense. That was
out of nowhere.
I'd never heard one word about Arizona's defense until like they had suddenly the best defense in the NFL. Seattle, the same thing. Seattle has this incredible defense. Then you watch them and you're like, their defense is no good. I mean, they just lost to the Bills. How good is that defense? And it's been that way throughout. It's not only as teams, but it's like as like individual parts of teams, like, oh, they've got a great offense, except this week they don't, you know, and I mean, that's been across the board. And to me, the best example of that has been the Packers. That Packers team went 15-1 last year, and there was talk of undefeated and they had this incredible, they're not very good. Then suddenly you just watch them and they're not very good. And then of course they lose a fluky game, they lose this. And you realize that within, like, if you could change 4 plays, they'd be like 5-1. If you could change, it's really incredible. It's incredible.
They're not the Packers are not very good, and they're also amazing.
Yes, exactly. Is that good?
I mean, it's ridiculous. Look at Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh lost to Tennessee on Thursday night. The Steelers lost to the Titans.
Yes.
I mean, this doesn't. It's so hard to watch football. I really wish more than ever that I had no rooting interest in the NFL because the games themselves are amazing.
Yes.
They're incredible. There are so many close games. There are so many upsets, so many surprises. And if it weren't for the fact that I've had my heart ripped out 3 times this year and I'm sure we'll have it ripped out many more times for the rest of the year, this would be great. But the problem is you have a rooting interest, and whatever team you root for, I mean, look at the Falcons. The Falcons needed a last-second field goal to beat the Lions or whatever. This is crazy. It's crazy. I really wish that I could use one of those flashy things, the neuralizers for Men in Black, and forget that I was ever a fan of a specific team. Because if you could just sit back and watch the NFL, let the NFL wash over you without caring about the results of any of the games, this is the greatest. It's the greatest sport in the world. And that's why there were all of the miserable injuries and the awful concussion stories and the horrible stories about what happens to these guys over years of abuse. We still watch the games because the sport is so great and the league is so great and it's so well run. And there really is, more than ever, there is parity in this league. And you just never know what's going to happen week to week.
Well, it's become the Red Zone League. I mean, you just watch the Red Zone channel and it's incredible. And it's just like, wow, it's there's a video game feel to it. And something's happened here, something's happening here. But I look around and I need for me as a fan, I need a little more stability. I just need. That's why I love baseball, and that's why I don't. That's why it drives me nuts about the baseball. It's 162 games. You win today, fine. Like, I want to know: are the Eagles a good team or are the Eagles a bad team? I have no earthly idea. Nope.
They are both. You have to accept the fact that they are both a great team and a terrible team, and that's true of it. I mean, look at the best example of this is last night's game, right? It's Denver San Diego. It's the first part of the game is 24-0 San Diego. The second part of the game is 35-0 Denver. I mean, that happened in the same game. And that you just have to accept that every team is great and terrible. And that goes for I think that's true of every team in the league. There's obviously maybe you'd say the Chiefs, Jacksonville, I guess Cleveland, although they had a good game the other week. Maybe the Saints with all their problems, maybe Carolina. But, Carolina's 1-4. Would it surprise you at all if for one tiny second, if suddenly Cam Newton caught fire and they beat the Cowboys on Sunday and then they went to Chicago and beat the Bears? No, it wouldn't surprise you because they're both great and terrible.
Yes. There were people picking the Panthers to go to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, well, some of the Panther players, if I'm not mistaken, were picking the Panthers to go to the Super Bowl.
Good call on their part. Well, part of that is that quarterbacks are great and terrible. I mean, that's there are certain guys, you've the Brady thing and Rodgers. Rodgers having a down year with a 98 quarterback rating or something. It's a stupid, thing.
Yeah.
But Cam Newton was great last year. He was so great. He wasn't just great as statistically, and you'd watch him. He'd just amaze you 10 times a game. Amaze you with a throw, amaze you with a down and out, how strong his arm is, amaze you with a 3rd-and-3 run. This year, he's brutal. He's brutal, and you're just going, how is that even the same guy? But that's this league. That is what this league is. Doesn't it? But it's it's adjustments, but it's almost not even adjustments anymore. It's almost just a matter of time needing to pass. Because a certain amount of time passes, okay, now you get to be the other guy again. It's crazy.
I think that some of this, and I don't know, this is a sort of a pop psychology analysis, but I think some of it has to do with the fact that there are more and more pro-style offenses run in college. And so more and more of these offensive weapons, especially wide receivers and quarterbacks, are showing up ready to play. I mean, it used to be, it took forever to break a quarterback in. It took years, Peyton Manning had a pretty mediocre first year, and then he got good in the second and third years, and that was remarkable that he was able to adjust that fast. And now you've got Griffin and Luck and these guys coming in, and just instantly they're up to the task. That didn't used to be the case. I mean, there are wide receivers you can draft out of college now, and in their rookie years, they're, 1,400 yards and 90 catches and stuff. And I think that's why year to year it's so impossible to predict. It's because a couple guys from college can be instant difference makers, and teams can go from, 1-15 to 9-7 to make the playoffs. So it is really, truly fascinating. And I can't wait to see what happens, even though every week it makes me so nervous to watch the games the Patriots games, I almost can't watch them. Like, it's gotten to a point where I just want to cover my eyes and maybe just turn off the TV and just learn later what happened. it's too nerve-wracking.
Well, it's so complicated. I mean, there was a play in the Broncos-Chargers game where Manning, you know, is doing his little pointing thing and pointing at different guys or whatever, and then his receiver kind of gives him, like, a sign, and I don't know what language they're talking, but Manning gets the ball, takes a snap, the blitz is coming, he throws it out, the guy, the receiver, goes upfield instead of stopping, pick six, okay?
Yeah.
And I'm watching that play, they showed it from a bunch of different angles, and they're ripping the receiver. And I'm thinking, the receiver, how bad, I mean, how tough is it to be a wide receiver in the NFL now, where you have to read the quarterback's mind based on, like, I mean, like, okay, we get Peyton Manning's a genius, okay? He's a football savant. He can see the whole field. But you're, like, some lonely wide receiver out there. You've got to know precisely, okay, that guy's blitzing. This guy's here. I'm the hot read. I got to go here. I got to stop. I got to do this. And if you don't, it's like your team might lose the game. Simply because
yeah.
You just did that, you know?
Yeah.
And that I was just watching that, just thinking how many things can go wrong on any play. And if they do go wrong, it could be a touchdown, and that could be the game. That could literally be it. I mean, maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's just that nobody can play consistently. Well, I mean, very few teams can play consistently on that high level because there's just so many trap doors you can fall through.
Yeah, I mean, it is true now that wide receivers, I mean, everything is option routes.
Yes.
It seems to me that everything, it's just what the coverage is. You've got seven different patterns that you can run, and it's based on the things the quarterback is barking out, and is the weak side linebacker dropping into coverage, or is he crowding the line? Are they in cover two? Are they in Tampa two? Are they in cover three? What's how, like, are they blitzing? Is there a corner blitz? Is it a safety blitz? And it's no longer like, well, I know what I'm doing. I'm running 8 yards straight forward and then running a, you know, slanting towards the post. Now you've got nine things that
yes.
you have to do.
Yes.
And if you, like you said, it's very obvious when the quarterback and the receivers aren't on the same page now, because the quarterback throws a ball to no one and the receiver is 40 yards downfield and turns around with a look on his face like, what happened? I'm sorry. I thought I was doing this thing. And it's now the responsibility for the offense is on everyone's shoulders.
It's incredible, though, because at the same time, quarterbacks are completing 70-75% of their passes.
Yeah.
Throwing no interception.
Yes.
I mean, back in the old days, when you knew when the receiver would go, you would throw like 17 touchdowns, 22 interceptions. I mean, it was like,
yeah,
it's amazing the more complicated it's gotten. That's where we'll have this discussion at some point, because I think it's really a good one. What is the biggest gap between what the fan thinks is happening on the field and what is really happening? Like, what sport has that biggest gap? No question, it's football. There's not even the slightest question, and on about 20 different levels. I mean, the violence and the speed of the game and all these sorts of things. But just what is actually going on a single play in the NFL is, I don't care how many times you've played Madden, it's mind-boggling what these guys are thinking about out there.
Yeah, yeah. I would say that my worst nightmare would be to be dropped in as the middle linebacker in a football game. That's like the worst fate that could befall me.
Yeah.
It's so terrifying what these guys go through on every play, with the risk of injury and the things that they have to keep in their minds, and also now the multitude of rules to protect the players, which I think are all great, but now you're just doing your job and you might again get flagged if you hit a guy, if you go to tackle someone, you hit them a fraction of a second too late, literally a fraction of a second. That's a 15-yard penalty. It gives the other team a first down. They march. They score a touchdown. They win. There's no question that the biggest gap in that regard is in football.
Oh,
easily.
Yeah. And by the way, if you hit that player a split second too late, they'll show it in replay in such slow motion, you will look like an axe murderer. I mean, you will.
Yeah.
Like, you're in the action and you're like, oh, the guy's hit, you hit him, and like, oh, they throw the flag, like, oh, I hit him late. And then they show it on replay, and it looks like you waited like 10 minutes, you had a snack before you actually like took yeah. the guy out. I mean,
and on that play, like your job is, okay, you have to chip the tight end coming off the line and disrupt his route. Then you have to drop back, but you're also you're playing spy on the quarterback. Then there's a pass over the middle, and you run and you do what you've been training to do all your life, and you fly through the air. You risk your life and limb, fly through the air, try to jar the ball loose. You get there a tenth of a second too late. You're called for a 15-yard penalty that hurts your team. And millions of people watching this on replay at home and in the stadium are going, what the hell, man? Come on. That's a stupid play.
Like, come on. That's
come on. Just furious at you. Yeah. I mean, it's my worst nightmare. There's nothing scarier to me in the world than being just dropped into being a middle linebacker in the NFL.
That is until we start the draft. Because this is going to be a nightmare for you, I believe. all right, well, I think I'll explain it. You have the first pick in this draft, but I'll explain the draft.
All right.
This week's draft, you know, I people are going to feel the way they're going to feel about it. Sports equipment minus balls.
That's correct.
That's this week's draft.
And we've done a draft of just of different balls in sports.
Yes.
So we're eliminating balls from this.
Balls are out. No ball.
Just any piece of sports equipment. So, again, this is a little risky. It's a little political. It's a little kind of, you know, technical and philosophical, and I hope people go along with us for this ride.
We could lose some people. We could. I mean, we could lose some people. We're just going, wait a minute, I'm just an average sports fan. I can't – I didn't know we were going to go this deep, but I'm sorry. You know, sometimes it's just worth taking the chance.
All right. Well, let's see what happens.
You have the first pick.
With the first pick in the draft, I select the baseball glove. Baseball glove, probably in terms of its constitution, it's the material, the leather material, the thwack that the ball makes in the glove when you catch it, the symbolism involved. The baseball glove is so loaded with symbolism and like parent kid memories. It's the Hemingway short story of sports equipment. It's the most beautiful, symbolic, wonderful thing. It's about fathers and sons and fathers and daughters and just generations. And it's handed down. My glove that I use to this day was the glove that my dad used before. And then he gave it to me, and you rub it with oil and you put the ball in it and you wrap it in a belt and put it under your pillow. It's incredibly beautiful piece of equipment. It's very symbolic and lovely. And I think it's an easy, easy number one choice.
Yes. Now, you know, it's funny because I, of course, had the baseball glove at number one for me. But I actually was splitting it up. I actually had the catcher's mitt, the first baseman's mitt, and the glove. The typical
Interesting.
Glove is a separate entity. So you took all of those with your one pick, which is...
I did.
I mean, we'll get a ruling on it, but it seems like it's probably okay.
The ruling just came in. It's okay.
The glove is awesome, and it really, you know, the new gloves that you can buy, and having gone to for my daughters to buy them gloves, you don't have to break them in, which in
I don't cases, I don't like that. No, I know like that either. That's true, and I don't like that at all. I think that's a huge mistake.
Yeah, I mean, there you don't have to oil them. You don't have to put them under your bed. You don't have to tie it up with string. I mean, I guess it's better. I mean, it's sort of one of those things that's like, it's better, but it's worse. Because it's like, I get it. I understand. It's like the leather's softer. It probably is better. I remember once I was playing shortstop with my glove, and a line drive came at me, and it went through my glove. It literally went through the glove because the webbing was that cheap. So
yeah.
I get it. I get the higher quality, but... It's a bonding thing that it feels like you should be able to at least have the option to buy the bonding glove. You
know? That bums me out. It bums me out in the same exact way that it bummed me out when they started curving the brims of baseball caps.
Yes.
You know, because that was like the parabola of a baseball cap brim is something that you earn. It's something that you gradually bend with your hands, and it's from like the sweat from playing, you know, outside with your friends, and it slowly slowly curves downward. And then they started pre-curving them, and it's like, well, that's no fun. What's the point of that? The whole point is that you get it, and it's dorky and flat, and then you work it down over the course of many hard-earned hours.
Yes, absolutely. Well, like I say, maybe that should be an option. Maybe it's a company we could start, the Bonding Baseball Glove. Where
All right.
you only buy it, it's old, it's going to be horrible compared to everybody else's awesome glove. But yeah, you and your father or you and your mother will be able to actually bond over breaking it in. Which, by the way,
I love it.
The gloves never get broken in. You have to leave them out in the rain for like 2 days. All right. Excellent first pick. I got to give that to you. Excellent first pick. My first pick, because you took baseball glove, is the mouthpiece. And the mouthpiece goes across sports. And the reason I love – well, there are two reasons I love the mouthpiece as a sporting equipment. One, I love the idea of any piece of equipment that is protective in such a specific way. It's basically put this in so you don't get your teeth knocked out. That's it. That's all. It serves no other purpose. That's the only – it's not so you can, like, breathe better or run. No. Just put this in, and this way your teeth will not get knocked out. So I love that. I love the specific. And two, and this is awful for me to say that, to say this, because it's such a barbarian thing to say, but I'm just going to say it anyway. There's nothing quite like seeing a guy get his mouthpiece knocked out. Like in boxing, it's horrible. I know. I'm cruel. It's terrible. But, I mean, like watching Mike Tyson like reach for the mouthpiece after it got knocked out and all that, I mean, that's... that speaks to violence in a way that, like, a million hits cannot, you know? I mean, sometimes the mouthpiece is loose, and it doesn't even take that good a hit to take it out. But you knock somebody's mouthpiece out, that's the height of violence.
That's the universal symbol for you have succeeded in your job of attacking the other person. Just a mouthpiece flying away in slow motion.
You have been attempting to hit me. That proves you were successful.
You have succeeded, yeah. All right. Interesting. Interesting first pick. Very interesting.
Yeah, I'm going off the board a little bit.
For number two, I'm going to go with the football helmet.
The helmet.
Great. To me, just a great symbol of the game that it represents. It's so hard, and it's got the cool... you know, it's all the different permutations of the mask, I think, are great. I used to love, I had a book when I was a kid where they showed all the different kinds of, you know, crossbar masks. You know, the punter has the one bar that just goes across, and then the defensive ends have, you know, a huge, massive grid. Some of them, guys who have eye injuries, can put the Darth Vader, you know, black shades across the thing. And the other great thing about the football helmet, besides just being this kind of solid, hardcore representation of its sport, is that it's got the team logo on it.
Yes.
And that, when I was a kid, seeing team logos of the NFL gave me a crazy feeling of excitement. Like, all of them. I loved the logos so much. I used to collect the mini helmets of every team. And every team, even the ones that I didn't care about, the Chiefs logo, the Steelers logo, the Giants logo, something about that old-timey NY. I just loved that they all had that. And I memorized the trivia. You know, the Browns are the only team whose helmet has no logo, and the Steelers are the only one that has only have a logo on one side. And I just love that it's such a solid reminder of the sport that it's used in, and also that it is the ultimate representation of the team.
I should point out here that the helmet has definitely created a lot more violence and damage than the mouthpiece. I should just at least suggest that point. My favorite thing about the helmet, and I've said this before, but I never ever get tired of this. The Dolphins helmet, which is such a great helmet, and I used to collect, I used to collect the minis as well. The Dolphin helmet, the Dolphin is not wearing a Dolphin's helmet. Right, the Dolphin, the helmet on the Dolphin is an M, so he's like wearing a University of Miami helmet, which I love that. And because to me it's like he could have been wearing like a Dolphin's helmet, and then like the Dolphin on his head could have been wearing a Dolphin's helmet. It could have gone like on to infinity, and it was clear that the person drawing the logo was like, too complicated. I'm not. I am going with the M. I love that. And I love the helmets are great. The logos on helmets. I was actually just last night watching that game marveling at how awesome the Chargers helmet is.
Fantastic.
That's such a great helmet. What is the best helmet in the NFL?
I thought about that a lot, honestly. And I think, as much as I hate to admit it, I love the Steelers helmet.
Yes.
I think it's so perfect for that team. I love that it's only on one side for some reason. Just makes it interesting. But I don't, they're all good. I mean, who doesn't love the, who doesn't love the 49ers helmet? The 49ers helmet's amazing.
Yes.
And the, and the, I mean, the, there are some bad ones. I think the Seahawks helmet is kind of bad. I don't love it.
Bengals helmet. What about the Bengals helmet?
Bengals helmet's kind of bad. You know what's a great helmet is one of my least favorite teams in the world is the Cowboys. What an amazing helmet that is with that blue and white star. That's a great helmet. And I love it when they wear their throwback uniforms, those old white and silver throw. Just everything about it is great. The Panthers helmet is the worst helmet. I'm going to say that. I think the Panthers helmet is the worst.
Yeah, well, you know what? It's hard on the fly to just come up with a helmet. I mean, that's what...
Yeah.
Because like, the Jacksonville helmet's no good either. I mean, it's
no.
It's hard on the fly to come up with a new helmet. All right,
yeah.
Last question on the helmet then. What's the better helmet? Old Patriots, new Patriots?
Oh, old Patriots by far.
By
no
far,
question.
Right? It's not even...
It's not even... They're not playing the same game, the old Patriots helmet and the new Patriots helmet. It's so, so easily far and away the old one. And it's a bummer that they ever changed it.
I was going to say, that had to be a depressing moment when they changed that, because that helmet rocked. Absolutely.
It was. And they went in that direction. That, like, the same thing with the Seahawks helmet. That kind of, like, there's a kind of, like, the symbol on the helmet is always like in motion, kind of from the back of the helmet towards the front of the helmet, and the new one stinks. And the best helmets are just the symbol. It's like the Saints helmet is a great helmet because it's just that symbol that you could see that Saints symbol anywhere in the world on any building. You could be in Botswana, and if you saw the Saints symbol spray painted on the side of a wall in a marketplace, you'd be like, oh, that's the Saints symbol. You know, like you just they're so instantly recognizable and great. And I hate all the new ones, the kind of like swooshing forward nonsense. I just hate all of that stuff.
I agree. Well, the old Patriots helmet, that guy ruled. I mean, that
Patriot, yeah.
Yeah, the Patriot ruled. He was just awesome. All right, well, I'm going to come right back at you with football, and I'm going to go with the kicking tee as my second choice. Love the kicking tee for again, two reasons. One is that somebody invented it. The fact somebody invented the kicking tee, and they were like, all right, how do I do it? How do I do something? I just want a little piece of plastic that holds the football up. That's all I really want. You know, and they had to go through all these different designs, and I love the idea of the kicking tee. But the second thing is, and I miss this so much, you remember, you might not be, I'm a little older than you, so you might not remember, when college football, they would kick field goals with the kicking tee.
Yeah, I remember that, sure.
Awesome. Just awesome. You could just, like, just put the ball down on the tee. Don't even have to hold it. I mean, I guess by rule you had to, like, keep your finger on it or whatever. But
yeah,
that to me was just so great. That was like the old NBA 3-to-make-2 free throw thing.
It's yeah, sort of like, yeah.
Field goal kicking is not easy enough. Let's give you the tee.
Another great thing about the kicking tee is it creates one of the greatest jobs that anybody has in football, which is the guy, sometimes a child, who immediately after the kickoff sprints out to the middle of the 30-yard line and grabs the tee and then runs back. They have a person who does that. They have a person who runs out as fast as they can, grabs the tee and runs back before getting trampled by 22 crazily large men.
It's awesome. It's just awesome.
It's fantastic, yeah.
And people like they bid. I mean, it's like you have to be a contest winner to get to be like the tee person. The tee, really everything. I love when they use the tee like in creative ways, like for onside kicks. They put the ball, they lean it up against the tee, or they put it sideways on the tee. I mean, it's because to me it's like the tee should be pretty limiting, but the human mind can do so many amazing things.
All right, for my third pick, I'm going, it's a little reach. It's a reach at three, I'm not going to lie to you.
Okay.
But I think there's real value in this pick. It's the basketball headband.
Oh, the headband.
Love the headband. Love the headband. First of all, because you see basketball highlights from any era, and there's always guys wearing headbands. Second, which is a nice sort of connective piece of tissue for the sport. Second of all, it's the weirdest thing that basketball players do is wear headbands. Most of them are bald or have shaved heads. Many of them are. And yet they wear the headband to keep, obviously to keep the sweat out of their eyes, but also like as a fashion statement. Rajon Rondo wearing a headband is one of the funniest, weirdest things that you see. LeBron James, the easily the best athlete in the sport and one of the greatest basketball players of all time, wears a headband. Great players wear headbands. Terrible players wear headbands. and they look so funny, and it's somehow they pull it off. Like, if you see a headband is not an easily pulled off fashion accessory.
Yes.
But when you see LeBron or Allen Iverson or any of those guys wearing them, it looks so cool. I don't know how they pull it off, but I love any shot of a basketball player wearing a headband is great.
It really is amazing, because there was a time when people who wore headbands, first of all, were the biggest like dweebs who ever lived. Right? Right? You've seen people like with a headband, like what are you doing? You know. And secondly, they don't sweat into the headband. I mean, they wear the same headband like the whole game, and
yeah.
it's not like the headband is serving any purpose at all.
It may serve a little purpose, but still, anyone wearing a headband, you see them, it's 4 minutes into the game, sweat pouring down their face.
Yes, oh yeah, absolutely.
Just completely ineffective.
What about the old wristbands? Were you a wristband
Love them.
Guy, like in tennis?
Love them. When I played tennis as a kid, I always wore wristbands. Felt very, very cool wearing wristbands,
yeah, wristbands
playing tennis.
Wristbands, yeah. I mean, the idea of a band is great anyway.
Yeah.
But the headband, that's the other thing. How did the headband come back? I mean, there was a really... pretty long stretch of time where there were no headbands.
Yeah, I don't know, but it is definitely back. I mean, they a lot of guys wear them now. Almost all the guys wear them.
I'm going completely off the board at number three. I'm taking the tennis ball hopper as number three. There is nothing, you know, because of course I'm fascinated by the inventions of like incredibly just somebody came up with this idea. For those that don't play tennis. The tennis ball hopper is like this device, and I say device like it's mechanical or something, where you can pick up tennis balls by basically slamming down this wire box on top of the ball, and it
yep.
will pop into the wire basket. That's basically
yep.
what the hopper is. And then, of course, later they invented a way you could open it up and use it. Like you don't have to bend down to pick up the ball or something.
There's also the kind that are on wheels where they sort of gather. They have like a big V on the
yes.
front of it, and it
yes.
gathers the balls in and then sort of sucks them up into the basket.
But that one feels almost like too modern to me. I like the kind you're just jamming the hopper right on top of the ball. You're just like I am going to buy four. And supposedly the best thing about this, it's supposedly easier to pick up the ball. Like, reaching over and picking up the ball much harder than with like whatever length of force you have jamming this stupid wire thing on top of the ball in a way that it would pop in.
You know, this is a great choice for you, first of all. Let me compliment you. Great choice at number three. But the great thing about the tennis ball hopper is it's incredibly effective. It does its job.
Whether
it's pointless or not, it does its job incredibly well.
Yes.
And there's something very lovely about a person, whoever it was, his name was Carl Tennis Ball Hopper, I think, in the late 1940s. He saw a problem,
yes.
and he invented a thing. It's the great American way. And I'm by saying that, I'm guaranteeing that this was invented by a Belgian dude. But it seems like a great thing that someone did, that they were like, oh, this is a problem. When you practice tennis, there's balls all over the court. It takes forever to lean down and pick them up. I am going to invent a device that does that for you. And it's really effective.
It
they work really – even old crummy ones. My wife and I were on vacation a year ago and we played tennis, just very casually tennis. And there was a hopper, and we just went around after just knocking balls back and forth. And it worked. I remember marveling at how well the device worked. It's an incredibly successful device.
I think there's a theme growing with what I – because I feel the tee is the perfect – kickball device. It's like
mm-hmm.
kickball, put a T out there. And the hopper, yeah. I mean, if you got a bunch of balls, I every so often I still like going out and hitting against the ball machine. I've got 500 balls out there. Take the ball hopper. Just go out there and pick them all up.
All right. For number four, I am going with the hockey goalie mask.
The goalie mask. Very good.
Yes. Now, I'm not a huge hockey guy, but... goalie masks are incredibly awesome. They're intimidating. They're scary. You know they're intimidating and scary because they were famously used in a successful horror movie as the thing that the guy who killed people wore. That's a really big coup for the goalie mask.
Yes.
And also, it's such a successful item that it has been adopted into another major sport. Now a lot of catchers in baseball wear what amount to goalie masks
yes.
instead of the old catcher mask. And that is, again, a huge indicator that this piece of equipment is successful. And there is nothing cooler. The saddest thing in the world for me, and again, I'm not a big hockey fan, but I hate seeing what goalies look like in real life because you want to believe that they look like the hockey mask, the goalie mask. That's what you want to think goalies look like. And when you see them and they're just like normal-looking Canadian gentlemen, it's always a little bit disappointing to me because they don't look nearly as scary and awesome as they do when they're wearing their mask.
The goalie masks are so awesome. And I think they're so awesome because of this. So for a long time, goalies did not wear masks, which is absurd. There's no level of absurdity that could reach that, you know? I'm going to stay here in the goal, completely unprotected along the face area, and have you shoot pucks at me. I mean,
at 100 miles an hour,
So these guys, I mean, hockey players, let's be honest, these guys are tough. I mean, these guys are insanely tough. If you told all of them they don't have to wear helmets anymore, they wouldn't wear helmets. None of these guys wear helmets. They're nuts. They're insane. So at some point they said to goalies, you got to wear something on your face. I mean, this is getting ridiculous. And they came up with something so scary that nobody could make fun of it. I mean, nobody. It's sort of like if you put on like a regular mask, like a catcher's mask, it'd be like, what are you, a clown? I mean, what is this, you know? But you put on one of those masks, okay, I get it.
Yeah, scary.
Goalie mask, very, very good choice at four. I'm gonna have to give you that one. It's funny, I don't know what our limitations are for sports equipment, so I'm going to do it anyway because, let's face it, we're making the rules. I'm going with the Zamboni.
Wow.
I don't know that, I mean, it kind of feels like it's off the board, but I don't care. I don't even need...
You know, this is like the Yankees drafting Drew Henson when they were pretty sure he was going to go to Michigan to play football. It's like, it's unclear whether this is a good move, but if it works out for you, it's going to be huge. It's going to change your franchise forever.
That's the thing. If we get approval on the Zamboni, it's the steal of all steals at four.
It really is.
It's really it's the number one overall pick. It's taking Bo Jackson. It's the Royals taking Bo Jackson.
Absolutely.
I don't even need to say how awesome the Zamboni machine is. Everybody knows how awesome it is. So the only real question is, and obviously this is going to go to a panel of 12, I believe, in Switzerland, to determine whether the Zamboni is a fair pick.
I think it is. I think you found a way to skirt the system, basically. And it's a little dicey, and there's going to be a lot of talking heads on TV over the next few weeks that talk about it. You know, is your franchise corrupt? Even legal? All stuff. But I think you worked within the bounds of the rules that were established for this draft, which are lengthy and which are available online.
Online,
by the way,
at sportsonearth.com.
And I think it's a great move. You outflanked me on this one. I didn't see it coming. I didn't even have the Zamboni on my board because I didn't even consider it. But I think it's a great call. I think it's well done, and it may have put you in leading position in the draft through four rounds. So for my fifth pick, and by the way, I'm not even going to talk about how great the Zamboni. Everyone knows how great the Zamboni is. There's nothing to say.
It's
a Zamboni.
It's just awesome. By the way, here's the one question I want to ask you about the Zamboni. How long do you watch the Zamboni between periods?
The entire time.
The entire time. That's it.
The entire time. You watch it from when it comes out. You watch it from when it comes out to the last bit of ice being glazed over, and then you watch it until it leaves, and you watch it until the door closes. The entire time. You never take your eyes off.
And it's a whole experience because you're watching, like, the end when only that one little piece of ice is, like, white and chipped, and you're like, can't wait for that to become glossy and cool.
Yeah.
And then watching him, like, try to maneuver on the actual new wet ice and how much tougher that is as a driver.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. It's an amazing, amazing aspect of sports in the world.
Okay.
All right, before I give you my fifth pick, I'm going to give you a special pick, which is worst piece of equipment in sports. Easily, this is not a close second. It's the football chains. The football chains are by far the dumbest thing that exists in any sport. A play is run, a runner falls down, the referee places the ball at a spot approximately close to where the ball might have been in relation to the ground when the runner's knee hit the ground, which is itself impossible to tell. Then they stand there and hold the ball on the ground as if the ball is going to get up and run away. Then two guys 40 yards away rush out holding these chains, and they line them up on the ground. Now, never mind the fact that because it's just a 10-yard chain, if the angle that they move the chain at, that they lay the chain out, is even like a degree off, it completely changes whether that's 10 yards or not. Never mind that for a second. Then they arbitrarily place the chains down at a spot roughly around where they think they were. Then they pull them taut, and then they study it for a really long time, make sure, oh, yeah, okay, this is a quarter of an inch past the ball, and they signal fourth down or first down or whatever it is. It's the in this modern world that we live in, it is truly insane that the most popular sport in America is still guided on a play-by-play basis by this incredibly antiquated and stupid system.
By the way, don't you? Yeah, and not exactly the most efficient system in the world. You have to hire like three people to do it. There are three people, four people, five people in some games. That's their job. We got to measure this thing. Get a few of your friends. I mean, it's like, how many people do you need? But the guy I think that's the most underrated guy in the chain gang experience is the person who has to, like, put that little thing in the middle and line that one up on the actual yard line. Like, that guy, that job is terrible.
That's a tough job.
Terrible job. You don't even get to stretch the chain. You get nothing to do except for – and it really is, honestly, if we sat here for the next – hour and a half trying to come up with a less efficient system for measuring football, we could not do it. You have to be like, well, maybe you could use elephants somehow. There's no way you can come up with something worse than three guys running out in the field, trying to sort of maybe line it up. The guy in the middle kind of has that little marker to line it up on the yard marker and then pull it stretch.
Yeah.
But
it's truly amazing.
It would just wouldn't be football without it.
No, you're right. So that's the worst piece of equipment. And with the fifth pick in the draft, I am bypassing some huge high-profile choices. I'm bypassing the baseball bat.
Yes.
I'm bypassing the pylon, which was on my board for a long time.
I love
the pylon. I'm bypassing the putter, which I think is a good choice.
Ooh, putter is good.
And I'm going with a very risky pick, which is the knee brace.
Ooh, the knee brace.
Yeah, so here's my reasoning on this. The knee brace, to me... First of all, it's worn in multiple sports, which I like. And what it symbolizes to me is the veteran warrior. It symbolizes the guy who's been through a lot, who's tweaked his knee a bunch of times, who maybe had surgery. That telling kind of outline of the knee brace under the football pants is very, very moving to me.
Yes.
Because it's like, it's a guy who's like, he's in the second half of his career. Usually he's holding on. He loves the game so much. He's got to keep playing it. But it's like, this is not the young spring chicken fresh out of college, who's like, just running around. This is a guy who has to work at it a little harder, who has to, who gets in the whirlpool after every practice and he's sore and beaten up. There's something very sort of lovely and kind of moving about the knee brace to me. And again, I love that it's like, women's volleyball and, basketball, soccer. People wear knee braces in every sport, and I love that.
Yes, well, the knee brace, basically what you're saying is, if the knee brace could talk, it would tell the best stories. Love the knee brace. Knee brace, it's a very good pick. It's a very good pick at number five. I'm going to pass on a couple. I'm going to pass it sort of really regretfully on this one. I'm going to pass on the wrist thing that bowlers use to keep their wrist straight.
Sure.
Love that thing. Love that.
Great.
You want to talk about telling a great story. I mean, that wrist thing. there was a point where that guy went, I'm not keeping my wrist straight. I gotta do something about it. The lacrosse stick, awesome. Totally
sure.
Awesome. You had the putter. I was very seriously thinking about the sand wedge, which I think is an awesome thing. And the pylon. Neither one of us drafting the pylon is a real regret, because the pylon
is going to be a walk-on free agent on one of our teams. There's no question.
It'll definitely.
They're getting a free agent contract in training camp, and the pylon will find a team. I have no doubt about that.
For baseball, I mean, for the final pick, I've got to go though with the baseball donut. The donut I was very tempted to take it earlier because I was worried I'd lose it. But, the donut, To me, the donut is great because, first of all, it's still, you want to talk about something that does what it's supposed to do. That's all, you're just, all you're doing is make the bat heavier. That's it. That's the only job, and it does it just beautifully. Just beautifully. And everything about putting the donut on, slamming the bat down to get the donut off, all of those things. And it, I hate it. I hate watching baseball players now in the on-deck circle with, like, that, like, Terminator 2-looking device where it's, like, they're swinging the bat, and it's, like, all metal, and it's... No.
Terrible.
No, no. The donut. And I use the donut, like... It, to me, the reference of the donut is, like, you can use that in any walk of life. Like, there's, like, once you get through something, you're like, hey, this is like swinging the bat without the donut. It's like almost anything in life works as a reference point to the donut.
Yeah.
And it's called the donut. I mean, come on. It,
yeah.
Everything about the donut is awesome.
No, it's amazing. And I have no evidence for this, but I have always strongly suspected that the donut is counterproductive. That by putting a donut on your bat in the on-deck circle and swinging it around, you're just tiring out your arms before you're at bat. I feel like it's a terrible idea. I feel like what you want to do is just like stretch and limber up and get ready. But it always struck me as odd that the thing you would want to do before you're at bat is really just weigh down your bat and your arms and tire your triceps out as you swing the bat around.
But is there a better feeling, though, than when they take that donut off and you're like, man, this bat is light. Look, I just feel so – it probably doesn't help you at all.
Well, the slamming down of the handle and having the donut fall off is the baseball equivalent of the, like, LeBron James chalking up your hands and then clapping with the dust cloud. It's like, all right, here we go, you know? It's great.
I love that the donut is so poorly designed, you have to do that to get the donut off. No, you can't just pull it off. No, slam that bat. And you'll see guys slamming it like 12 times and not able to get – they have to use that little bat chisel to get the donut off finally.
Yeah. It's interesting. I didn't really get close to picking this, but I was toying with choosing the pine tar towel or whatever thing is.
That's good.
Which is sort of the same idea as a donut. It's baseball preparation.
Baseball preparation. It's awesome. I think it's pretty clear that I won this. And I don't want to say anything too derogatory about your picks, because there were a couple of good ones in there. But
well, I think that much like the NFL, both of our drafts were fantastic and also terrible.
Also terrible. There's no question. People are going to definitely wonder how the heck I could have taken the mouthpiece.
Number one. You got to admit, that's a huge stretch.
I should have gone donut number one and mouthpiece number five.
You traded your entire draft for Herschel Walker, and you're never going to live it down.
As long as Zamboni holds up, I've won. There is no question. And which reminds me, we actually have we need to actually determine how we're going to give out prizes. But we did get a bunch of people that entered last time. You will be getting prizes. We're going to figure out how to make that work. If you think I won this draft, we'll have a piece up at sportsonearth.com. In the comments, just put Zamboni rules. I don't even think we need a second option here, but just in case we do, if you think Michael won the draft, you got to put in.
It's up to knee brace. How about knee brace?
Knee brace. Yeah. See, I would want to just put the knee brace tell stories, but that's too much. But if you just
it's Zamboni rules for you and knee brace rules for me.
Knee brace rules for you. I think that's fair. You know, now, by the way, I counted up the comments from last time, and not surprisingly, I won.
That's your sight. That's not fair. you're unduly influencing, but you've got home field advantage.
Well, it's not like you're going to put something in the middle of the show about it. You know, just have like, you know, one of the people say like, oh, by the way, vote for Michael's.
Yeah,
place, you know?
I'm going to have Amy Poehler do a PSA in the middle of the next episode. Where I'm going to do a campaign ad, basically. I'm going to have Amy Poehler in the middle of the show do a campaign ad for me to win this draft, and then we'll see who gets more comments.
Yeah, you might win that. Michael, this has been great. By the way, we didn't come close to pulling off the hour, but this is the shortest one we've ever done.
So. Great. Well, we're working on it. We're going to get this down to a tight hour by the 400th time we do it.
I'm going to lose one of my daughters over it, but that's okay. So, Michael, can't thank you enough. This has been great.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.